Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. And now, on with the show. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the Grant Williams Podcast. Joining me today is a friend of mine, Jared Dillion, who publishes the Daily Dirt Nap, which is a phenomenal piece of, as you would suspect, daily financial research. But he's also an author who's written, I think, 5 books now, and the latest of which, No Worries, is going to be published in January. And Jared sent me a copy of this book to have a read through, and it really is exceptional. So I was really keen to get him to come onto the show and talk about it. The subtitle of the book is How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life. And I think what Jared talks about in the book is incredibly important, not just for people already invested in markets, but in my mind, more importantly, for kids and young people who are coming into a world that's very, very different now than it has been for the last 20 years. So I'm very, very excited to have a chance to talk to Jared about No Worries, the rest of his books, and the Daily Dirt Nap. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Jared Dillion. Jared, welcome to the podcast, my friend. This is a long, long overdue conversation. I'm glad we finally got this together.
Yeah, I mean, I remember I had you on my radio show a couple years ago, like three or four years ago. That was cool. But I've always wanted to come on the Grant Williams podcast, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's taken way too long to get this sorted out, but we have a great reason to do that, and that is your new book, which we're going to talk about in a minute. There's a bunch of other stuff I want to talk to you about, but before we get on to No Worries, which I have to say is a tremendous read. I mean, you sent me a copy to read prior to publication, and you know, there's always that moment when friends send you books and you think, oh God, I hope it's good. And this was, and I wrote back to you at the time, said this is absolutely, not only is it a tremendous book, I think it's a really, really important book and completely different to all the other books you've written. But before we get on to No Worries, and I want to spend the majority of the day talking about that, talk a little bit about your writing career, because I cannot think of anybody who's written 4 more different books than you.
It's funny, when I wrote Street Freak, that was published in 2011, that was not my idea. I did not set out to be a writer. I basically was recruited to write that book by a literary agent, and I didn't want to do it. And initially I said no. And then 6 months later, he came back and said, you have to write this book. So I did that.
And, and what was the pitch? What was his pitch to you? What was the book that he described to you? I know what the book turned out like, but was it the same? What did he pitch you on?
I think the book that they were initially thinking of was sort of something like what Larry McDonald did, which was really a journalistic sort of book. I would interview 150 people and write a book about Lehman's collapse. But that wasn't the book I wanted to write. I wanted to write the book about my struggles with mental illness while I was at Lehman, which was a completely different book. And when I told them that that's the book that I wanted to write, they're like, oh my God, yes, like this is going to be terrific. 5 years later, I wrote a novel. It's called All the Evil of This World, which remains my favorite book. It took me 5 years to write. I put a lot of work into it. The third book is Those Bastards, 69 Essays on Life, Creativity, and Meaning, which just came out in April. And this, No Worries, is a personal finance book. So my first 4 books are memoir, novel, essays, nonfiction. And my 5th book, which I want to come out next year, is going to be a short story collection. So I don't think that's ever been done in the history of writing. I don't think somebody has ever done memoir, novel, essays, nonfiction, and short story collection. I don't think it's ever been done.
Yeah, as I said to you, I can't think of a more different and eclectic collection of books. And you know, each one of them very different to the last, and each one of them incredibly readable. It's a real gift. You know, I sit and try and write some kind of story for a living, and it's not an easy thing to do, but you have a real gift for taking complex ideas and complex storylines and weaving them together into something that is not only easy to read, but enjoyable to read. Talk a little bit about your writing journey, because I know you went to creative writing classes and all kinds of things that I've never had the balls to do. Talk a little bit about your journey in the writing world.
I was a good writer in high school. I actually won a kind of a prestigious national award in high school, but I didn't really consider myself to be a writer. I considered myself to be a mathematician, and I majored in math at the Coast Guard Academy. but I also won a couple of writing awards at the Coast Guard Academy. And then for some years, I didn't really do much writing. And then in 2004, when I was at Lehman, I started writing those Bloomberg messages and I gained a really big following. And that's really when I decided I wanted to be a writer. And this is kind of like TMI, but I'm bipolar and I was hospitalized in 2006. I was literally in a psych ward and there was a woman that was coming in to do writing workshops with the patients. So one of the people at the hospital said, you should really go to this. So I went and I did this writing workshop with her and she was like, oh my God, you have to be a writer. Well, this woman is Siri Hustvedt, who is a brilliant writer, just fantastic. And I didn't really know who she was at the time, but for her to say, you should be a writer, that was kind of the moment when I said, that's what I'm going to do.
But still, you know, you didn't give up your career to become a writer. You managed to do what is very difficult to do, is take the idea of being a writer and actually make that bend to your day job, which is not an easy thing to do because they're both full-time jobs, right?
You know, I write the Daily Dirt Nap every day, which is basically 1,500 words every single day. And then in my spare time, I'm writing essays, I'm writing short stories, I'm working on books. On any given day, I'm writing like 5,000 words, like I write all the time. But like you said, I managed to combine two things that I love. One is the markets and two is writing. And it's really like I'm a very blessed person because I consider myself to be a writer first and an analyst second. Most people are the other way around. And I probably am one of the top 50 highest paid writers in the world just by virtue of what I do. So I'm incredibly fortunate. Like, it's just been terrific.
Tell me about the style of the Daily Dirt Nap, because it's just you on the page. But how has that evolved? Did you set out to structure something in a very given way and it's just morphed into being you? Was it just kind of stream of consciousness? Because again, there's nothing like the Daily Dirt Nap. It's brilliant and short. And, you know, I have this favorite quote of mine from Blaise Pascal, who said, you know, if I had the time, I would have written a shorter letter. And you pack so much. You know, you as a writer understand that, right? You get it. But you pack so much into those 1,500 words. It's a real skill.
Yeah, I have different writing styles for each of the things that I do. And for the Daily Dirt Nap, I do write very stream of consciousness. I write it very fast. You know, I'm probably done in about an hour and a half, like 90 minutes, and I'm done. And I could easily write another 10 pages every day. So it's like you said, there's a lot packed in those 3 pages of material, and it's been very successful.
Let's move on to No Worries, because this is, as I said, you sent me a copy, and I think it's such an important book, particularly today with what's going on in the world and what's going on in markets and the way they've changed. So let's talk about that journey. When you decided to write No Worries, again, what were you setting out to achieve? And walk us through the journey of writing that book, because it's, again, it's you're writing to a very different audience and you're writing in a very different way with this book than the other ones you wrote.
Well, you know, the book started from when I was doing my radio show. So I had a personal finance radio show for 2 years, which wasn't very successful. It was nationally syndicated, but I wasn't on a lot of stations. And it was a live show, and I would come into the radio station at 6 o'clock at night, and I would do this live show 5 nights a week. And really, you know, I was alone. I was alone in the radio station. Nobody was there. And it really felt like I was talking to myself. Like, I would just go into a room and talk to myself for 2 hours a night about personal finance, you know? And the 2 years I did that, I really started hitting the same points over and over and over again. And I kept coming back to this idea of financial stress, right? Because the personal finance industry is really focused on having people have the most money, but which causes them to do things that make them miserable, whether it's this extreme austerity where they're giving up coffee every day, or whether they're putting money in envelopes, or whether they're investing in aggressive growth mutual funds because that's what returns the most but also has the most risk. People were doing these things which increases their financial stress. And I said, that's not necessarily what you want to do. This isn't about having the most money. This is about being happy.
Right. But again, you know, writing about this, which is a subject that touches everybody's life, whether you know it or not, financial markets and money and personal finances touch everybody's life. And, you know, I remember when we were trying to hire a guy at Real Vision out of Saatchi & Saatchi, you know, super guy ended up coming to work for us. And I went to meet him in London and he'd spoken to everybody else. And they just said, look, you're going to be in London. Can you sit down and have a chat with this guy? We really want to hire him. And we sat down and we came from two very different worlds. And we sat at St. Pancras station in London, a very busy station. And we were supposed to meet for coffee for half an hour. We ended up sitting there for a couple of hours chatting. And at the end of it, he said, you know, this is all great and I love what you guys are trying to do, but the bit I just can't get my head around is, why is this important? Why would I leave the creative industry to come and do this in a world that's just completely alien to me? And I said to him, look, we've been here for 2 hours. How many people do you think have walked past us in this busy train station? And we kind of guessed maybe 25,000 people had walked past us in 2 hours in this. You know, this is the where the Eurostar for Europe comes into London. And I said, you know, every single one of those people is impacted by finance, and maybe 1 in 100 understands that. So this is important. So when I read your book, it struck me that this is such an important subject. It's not really taught in school. Like, kids don't learn this stuff. And you made such a superb attempt to try and explain to people why this stuff is important. So just let me know in your words why the concepts you've gone through in No Worries is so important to people to understand.
Gosh, what's the best way to put it? There's a little bit of an educational aspect to it. I think there's a lot of people out there who don't want to understand money because it's scary to them. It's new and it's foreign and it's complex and they don't want to understand it and they're scared of it. And there's a lot of people in relationships where there's one person in the relationship that handles all the money stuff and the other person is completely ignorant of it. So one of the messages of the book is that we are all individually responsible for our own financial education and our own financial future. Like you said, it's a different book. I'm writing for a different audience. I'm writing for really the average person and to get them to think about money in ways that they hadn't before. So the first part of the book is all about attitudes towards money. And in the first chapter, I talk about how in order to get money, you have to want money, which is a super interesting concept. And then I talked about this idea about the revenue side, right? That's what I called in the book, the revenue side, where it's a lot easier to increase your revenues than cut your expenses, right? Like the prevailing wisdom in the personal finance world is that if you cut expenses and cut expenses and cut expenses, you can get to $1 million. And that is possible. You can do that, but you will be miserable in the process. It makes a lot more sense to figure out ways to make more money, which is a lot more fun. So those are some of the things I was writing about.
So you start off with the attitude about people having to want money. Then you talk about the balance of it all, but then you get into the stress. And so let's talk about those stresses. You talk about debt stress and risk stress. So let's talk about debt stress first, because I think this is not just for personal finance, but way beyond that. This idea of debt stress is such an important concept.
Yeah. You know, I have an aversion to debt. In 2015, I bought the house that I'm currently living in. I took out what I thought was a pretty large mortgage at the time, and I paid it off in 3.5 years. And what a lot of people don't really understand is, when you eliminate that monthly payment, that money going out the door every month, when you get rid of it and you own the asset free and clear, it increases your happiness 100 times. You're so much happier when you don't have that monthly obligation. And a lot of people never get to experience that. A lot of people never experience that. They have bills to pay their entire lives. They will never own a house free and clear. And I talk about this in the book. I said, you never want to be a good customer of the bank, right? You want to be a bad customer of the bank. A good customer of the bank is somebody who borrows a lot of money, makes the payments on time every month, pays the maximum amount of interest, and just adds to bank profits. You want to be a bad customer of the bank. So either you don't borrow money in the first place, or you borrow it and pay it off very quickly, or you just default on the loan, which makes you a bad customer of the bank. But you do not want to be a good customer of the bank.
This is so true. I mean, the banks are in business and they all have those enormous great headquarters for a very, very good reason, because of all those good customers, right? And that's become more and more of a problem, particularly with interest rates doing what they're doing. In the idea of debt stress, you talked about credit cards, you talked about school, you talked about buying cars. You know, these are everyday things that everybody has just become so used to. And I don't think people really understand the way you go into this stuff. It's a whole different way of thinking about these. So talk about those everyday debts, credit cards, cars, school, and the way you look at it that perhaps will help people understand a different way of thinking them through.
Well, out of the ones you mentioned, the one you forgot was buying a house, which is the biggest one. Buying a house is the riskiest financial thing you will do in your entire life. And a lot of people don't really understand that because buying a house is so easy. You have help, you have real estate agents, you have attorneys, you have Fannie and Freddie, you have this whole system which has evolved to make buying a house as easy as possible. But if your hands are not shaking when you sign the loan documents, then you do not understand the risk of the situation. You're buying a house with 5x leverage, okay? If the price of the house goes down 13%, you are underwater. It is an enormous amount of risk. It's an enormous amount of risk, and people don't fully appreciate it. And also, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I have to do this for my classes. If you've ever built a mortgage amortization spreadsheet where you look at a mortgage and you see how it amortizes over time and how much interest you're paying, you know, with interest rates where they are today, if you get a house that's $100,000 more, you will pay $120,000 just in interest additionally over the life of the loan. So one of the things I talk about in the book is, don't just look at things in terms of the interest rate. Think about the dollars you're spending in interest and what you could be spending that on something else.
You know, which is such a great point, because in the last 20 years, it's all been about the monthly payment, right? Everything has been about what monthly payment can I afford, whether it's the new car, whether it's the mortgage. And because rates have been so low, people get into these bidding wars. They go, well, we'll just borrow another 100,000. You know, we'll match the bid because, you know, it only increases our monthly payments by X and we can afford that. And that mindset is so dangerous in a normally functioning world. We just happen to have not had a normally functioning world in terms of interest rates for such a long time now.
The thing with cars is that's, I don't know how it is in other parts of the world, but in the US, the car dealerships are essentially unregulated. They're not covered by Dodd-Frank. And if you go in to buy a car, typically what they do is they write a number on a piece of paper and they slide it across the desk at you. And they're like, that's your monthly payment. Does that work? And they don't tell you what the interest rate is. They don't tell you the term of the loan. They don't tell you the maturity of the loan. And like you said, it's just all about, we've been reduced to thinking about debt in terms of cash flow and debt payments. Like, and that's it. So,
yeah, but that, you know, when you talk about buying a house being the riskiest thing you're ever going to do, it's amazing how people have become conditioned to aspire to taking on this massive amount of risk. You know, it's become something that when they can't do it because the cost of housing has gone up, people are like incredibly disappointed. They're really upset that we can't take on this massive amount of risk. How do people need to rethink this approach to risk? And we'll get onto risk stress in a minute because it's such an important concept in the book. But how do people need to think about the stress that debt brings them to help them understand it better, do you think?
Well, I talk about it a little bit in the book. I talk about the emotional toll that debt can take on you if you're in a lot of debt. People lay in bed, staring at the ceiling, thinking about how they're going to make the next payment, how they're going to make the monthly payments. And it's a terrible way to live. I'd have a friend who was a very good customer of the bank. He had at one point $500,000 in credit card debt. He was paying $100,000 in credit card interest every year. And for him, he almost saw it as motivation. The debt motivated him to work harder to cover these payments. And I'm like, that is insanity. That is absolute insanity.
It really is. But again, what's the right way for people to think about this? How should people think about this stuff?
It's really about balance and moderation, which is the tough thing about this book, because extreme solutions are very easy to sell. So on one hand, you have Dave Ramsey, who says, cut up all your credit cards, pay cash for a car, don't take out any debt, just zero debt. And on the other hand, you have a guy like Kiyosaki who says, buy 20 rental houses and laundromats and take out as much debt as possible. So those are extreme solutions, which are very easy to sell because people understand them. The middle solution, the middle of the road solution, which is to have a balance where you say, look, debt can be useful. You can accomplish a lot with debt, but you want to minimize it. Nobody ever says that. Nobody has said that before.
And also, look, debt as an instrument is useful. People think it exists in isolation. The nature of debt changes depending on the environment. You know, debt has been a useful tool over the last 20 odd years because you've just had this tailwind. You know, it's been easy to roll over, it's been easy to borrow, and it has been a useful way to juice returns or to be able to afford to buy a house. But if you don't structure it right or you take it on at the wrong point in the cycle, its nature changes completely.
Well, that's certainly right about taking it at the wrong point in the cycle, for sure.
Well, and we're just going through that change in the cycle. We're going through that right now, right after a two-year period in COVID where everybody was going as far out over their skis as they could to buy that big house in the suburbs. We saw exactly what happened to house prices during that time. And it all happened within the refi window for an awful lot of people. So it feels like, you know, the timing of this book is extraordinarily good because I think there's going to be an awful lot of people that are going to be sitting there going, the hell's going on, and need to read the book.
As far as the risk stress goes, that's super interesting because that goes against a lot of the conventional wisdom as well. I mean, the conventional wisdom nowadays is that you should take all your savings and put it in the S&P 500 index fund. Basically never sell and dollar cost average and ride out all the drawdowns. And what I say in the book is that if you invest in an index, you get the returns of the index, which are very good, but you also get the volatility of the index, which is bad. The S&P 500 or, you know, the total stock market index has a pretty high volatility. The stock market moves on average about 1% a day. It moves on average about 16% a year. You have drawdowns of 30, 40, 50%. Vanguard, their whole marketing is about getting people to hold on through these drawdowns and not sell. But you can't expect somebody to get cut in half, to lose half of their savings and not panic and not sell. And let's say even if you could do that, even if you could behaviorally coach people to not sell, they will be miserable. They will be absolutely miserable. So why would you want to put yourself through that?
You go through this in the book, but so talk about the awesome portfolio, because when you get to that and at the end of that, I think it's at the end of the risk stress chapter.
So I invented this in 2019. I got it trademarked. The awesome portfolio is 20% stocks, 20% bonds, 20% cash, 20% gold, and 20% real estate. And you rebalance it every year. And the returns on this, since 1971, and we had to start in 1971 because that's when, you know, obviously gold, you could hold gold. The returns on this have been 8.1% a year with half the volatility of an 80-20 portfolio. And the biggest drawdown in any year was 12%, which was 2022. The drawdown in 2008 was 9.5%. So you're talking about this mix of asset classes where you return like 1% less than the stock market, but you have half the volatility. Who wouldn't want to do that?
I totally agree. And they're all, it's such a simple strategy. And these are all things that people are familiar with. We're not getting into any kind of complicated derivative structures here. I mean, cash, gold, stocks, bonds, real estate, they are, apart from gold probably, they're four things that everyone is going to own at some point in their life. So why not simplify things? Why not create a portfolio like this that, as you says, lowers the stress to the minimum amount possible?
This is how I basically invest for myself. I have a friend of mine, he approximates the awesome portfolio. I talked to him during the pandemic and stocks were down 30% during the pandemic. He was like, I was down 5%. I mean, it really is the silver bullet. It is the solution to this. It's very simple to implement and everybody should do it.
Well, you talk, the final part of the book is called relief. You talk about stability. So talk a little bit about the importance of stability and how that, both your mindset, your ability to handle stress, your ability to quantify risk, because it's such an important thing.
Well, a lot of that last chapter is really about moderation. and staying away from these extreme solutions. I talk a lot about spending habits, and I presented two hypothetical examples in that chapter of somebody who's very, very cheap and somebody who spends a lot. And neither of those people is right. Here's the interesting thing. You have, I would say, the vast majority of people in this country are very good with money. They're very frugal. They're very cheap. Yeah, I think so. I really do. I think a smaller percentage of people are what you would say bad with money. They spend too much and they go into debt. I think the majority are very good. But we take the people who are spenders and we say, these are the bad people. These are the people who are doing it wrong. They're in debt up to their eyeballs. They consume way too much. And these cheap bastards over here, they're the ones that are doing it right. But in reality, they're both sides of the same coin, and they're both extreme solutions. And just as there's such a thing as spending too much money, there's such a thing as spending too little money. And the consequences to spending too little money, I mean, you'll never go bankrupt, but it harms your relationships with other people. I'm sure you've known people in your life who are extremely cheap, and they are very difficult to be around. Somebody who like never picks up the tab, they leave lousy tips, they're hard to be around. So it harms their relationships with other people. Both extremes are bad. The goal is to have a healthy relationship with money. And having a healthy relationship with money means you don't really think about it all the time. You just don't spend your time thinking about it. If you go out to lunch with a bunch of guys and you end up picking up the tab, if you end up picking up the tab the next time, you're not like, these bastards, like they never pay. Like you just don't think about it. That's the place you want to get to, where you're not really thinking. You think about money two or three times a day when you take out your wallet to pay for lunch or something.
But it's easier said than done. And you spend a lot of time explaining how people need to think to get to this. But ultimately, it's a mindset, right? Because everybody's a bit unfair, but most people either aspire to have more money or aspire to have better things. And the people who aren't like that, the majority of them are worried about money, and they're stressed about being able to afford payments, and they're stressed about being able to go out for a fancy dinner or whatever it is. So give us some ideas how people can try and find that balance and reach that point you just described, which is the right way to think about it.
Well, I think that for a certain percentage of people, they actually derive no enjoyment or no value out of material possessions. Like there's some people, they don't want a BMW. They don't want clothes from Saks Fifth Avenue. They don't want any of these things. And what they do want is to sit on a big pile of cash and log into their bank account and see like two commas in there and just get a boner. Like, oh, look how much money I have in the bank. Like that's the enjoyment they derive out of it. And it's nuts, you know? So I think for some people, they really just don't derive any pleasure from material possessions. And in cases like that, I would say, okay, well, donate it. If it's just sitting there in your bank account doing nothing and you just count your money every day, then donate it and derive some pleasure out of that.
Well, I'm not sure those people would derive pleasure from that either. I get it. It's the hoarding instinct, right? It's the, I want to make sure I've got enough and my kids have got enough and all that kind of stuff.
And the hoarding instinct comes from a place of fear.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
It comes from a place of fear because human beings are very good at surviving. From an evolutionary perspective, we were hunter-gatherers, we were Neanderthals hunting woolly mammoths and protecting. And from an evolutionary perspective, we've been trained to survive. But thriving is very difficult for people. And for a lot of people to say, I deserve a $300 shirt. Like it's a nice shirt. I make enough money. I should buy this shirt. Some people never get to that point. Some people never get to that point of thriving. We're good at surviving, but we're not very good at thriving.
How should people's mindset change? Obviously, the book's come out this year, which is in the middle of a very different environment. But the people reading the book, many of them, particularly if they're in their 30s, let's say, or late 20s, they've grown up in a very different world to the one they face now. So what are the key changes in how people need to learn to think as opposed to how they've been conditioned to think about money over the last kind of 20 years?
You mean in terms of like the macro environment or in terms of
their own personal finances, the way they construct their own lives around money? let's say you're in your mid-30s now. You've grown up with your first experience with money, of earning your own money, you're all the way through school, your first jobs have all been in an environment which is very conducive to taking on debt, taking on risk. And now you're confronted with a very, very different world, that the risks are heightened, the danger is elevated. What are the lessons that people need to learn to tweak the way they think about risk and about money in this new world we're in?
You know, I think if you're in your 30s and you're really sort of investing for the first time and thinking about markets and stuff like that, then you have to invest in such a way that you're comfortable with the risk. And this is a lot about education. This is a lot of what this I try to teach this in the book. There is a perception that index funds are safe. I have heard this from financial advisors. Customers walk through their door and say, I want some of those safe index funds. like they don't have a concept of the risk associated with a broad market index fund. They don't have a concept associated with it. So part of the book is teaching people really about risk. There actually is a whole chapter about risk and how to think about risk and invest in such a way that you can stay invested. Because first of all, being invested is more important than what you invest in, and staying invested is more important than anything. So if you're in something that's too risky, that has too much volatility, and it's going to force you to sell at some point, you're going to stop compounding. You need to invest in such a way that you can keep compounding over time. So that's the way people should think about it. And from the debt standpoint, one of the kind of crappy things about this, I wrote most of this book in 2021 when we were in a low interest rate environment. If I were to rewrite this book or to have a second edition, I would talk more about a high interest rate environment. But in a high interest rate environment, you really have to be judicious in your use of debt. It mattered less 2 years ago. It matters a lot more today.
Totally agree. So how will people know, apart from the obvious, how will people know if they've taken on too much risk? Because a lot of times you don't realize it until it's too late. What are the telltale signs, apart from that kind of staring at the ceiling in the middle of the night?
The telltale signs are you're staring at your phone every 5 minutes to watch your positions, to see what they're doing. That, number one, is a telltale sign. And also, if you're experiencing emotions about your investment, when the number goes up, you get happy. When the number goes down, you get sad. You shouldn't feel any emotions at all if you're doing it right.
That's such a beautiful tip. Okay, listen, let's talk about the broader macro picture, because this is in your, I won't even call it your day job, I'll call it your daily job, writing the Dirt Nap. You do this every day. You write about what's going on in the markets. And the one thing I love about you and the way you write is, as we said at the top of the show, it's very colloquial, it's very stream of conscious, but you're so quick to change and shift and reverse your positions. And a lot of people get very dogmatic about their positions. So before we talk about the world at large and some of the things that you're focused on at the moment, just explain A, how you're able to do that, and B, how other people can acquire that skill of not getting attached to positions. Because for me, it's arguably the hardest thing to master in this whole crazy game that you and I found ourselves in.
Gosh, how would you get better at that? The thing is, you have a thesis, you have a position, you have a trade on, and you're constantly on the lookout for the arrival of new information. And new information can either reinforce your thesis or it can disprove your thesis. And a lot of people, when they're faced with information that can disprove their thesis, they discount it. They say, okay, that's not part of the thesis and I'm not going to pay attention to that. But you really have to be extremely open-minded and always open to the possibility that you might be wrong and you might need to reverse your position. Look, I don't do everything well. Like, that is one thing that I do well. I'm bad in other things, but I'm constantly trying to be as objective as possible with my positions and with my thesis and looking for the arrival of new information.
But how do you balance the ego component to this? Because, you know, most of the people in this business have a healthy ego. But ultimately, to be successful in what we're just talking about, you have to be able to suppress that. You have to be able to ignore that voice in your head that says, I'm smart in the markets. I got this right. How do you deal with that?
I got to tell you, I see this all the time on Twitter. There's a lot of egos on Twitter. Some person with 200,000 followers will have a trade in bonds or stocks or something like that. They're right for a while, and then they're massively wrong, and then they just get quiet. And what people don't understand in our business is that saying that you were wrong earns you a million times the credibility. I do that on Twitter when I'm wrong, like a couple times a year. I'll say, nope, got it wrong. And in the replies, people will say, I'm so glad you do this. I'm so glad you admit when you're wrong. Nobody else does this. It earns you so, so much credibility.
I agree, but it's not easy. Most people struggle with it, right? People have a really hard time, first of all, to your point just a minute ago, admitting to themselves that, hey, the picture's changed. I could be wrong here. And secondly, holding their hands up in public and saying, hey, I screwed this up. Do you seem to handle that ego component really, really well? You know, you're not shy when you do get something right. You celebrate your wins. But as you said, you're willing to hold your hand up to your losses. How do you do that? Is it just completely unconscious, or are you conscious about making sure that you're even-handed on both sides of the win-loss ratio?
I spend a lot of time thinking about ego, and I like to tell people I'm just another bozo on the bus. I'm on Twitter talking to people from Bridgewater and fund managers and billionaires and stuff like that. I am literally just a douchebag with a newsletter. Like, I'm not anybody special. You know what I mean?
Like, I know the feeling, my friend. I know the feeling.
Like, the only thing that makes me different is that I'm a good writer and I'm a good communicator and I'm kind of funny sometimes. So that's my shtick. I just try to keep the ego right sized. That's pretty much what it comes down to.
All right. Well, you do a good job of it, my friend. You do a good job, better than many that you and I could probably mention. Okay. So listen, let's talk about how you see this macro environment, because it would be remiss of me, now I've got you on here to talk about the stuff, not to get a sense of where you feel we are in the bigger picture. And you can pick wherever you think to start, wherever you think is most important, whether it's rates, whether it's fixed income, whether it's equities, whether it's gold, whether it's Bitcoin. I don't know. What do you think is the most important thing people need to be focusing on right now?
So I've had this thesis for a while that short-term rates were going to come down on the basis of a slowing economy that the Fed would cut. And the interesting thing is that this thesis has worked, but the economy has not really slowed. I figured we get some ugly payroll numbers, we get some good inflation prints, and I thought rates would come down. No, that's not what happened. Short-term rates are coming down because the Fed has basically decided that they're too restrictive and they're getting more comfortable with inflation coming down. So they're going to cut rates, basically. They're going to cut rates. So that has worked, but I don't know what's going to happen next. You know, one of the things about having a newsletter is that it's an incredible source of information, especially if you have a good relationship with your subscribers, because your subscribers tell you things. That, you know, just like a dumb example, they'll be like, oh, I went to the mall on Black Friday and it was totally empty. So you get these anecdotal bits of information from all over the country. And after a while, it's the mosaic. It starts to form a picture. And you say, gosh, the economy is really slowing down. And then you start looking at the data and you start working on the numbers and you say, okay, well, that confirms my thesis. But the economy is slowing slowly. Let's put it that way. The economy is slowing slowly. And I thought by now we would be in recession, which I'm not alone in that. Like, I think a lot of people thought that. I thought we'd be in recession by now. I still think it's possible. I mean, yield curve inverted 17 months ago. The curve is uninverting. We usually get a recession when that happens. It's still not happening. So I'm a little bit puzzled by it, right? But it doesn't matter whether I'm right on the economy. It matters that I'm right on the trade. And I've been right on the trade. So that has worked out.
What do you do when, like this, you're right for the wrong reasons? Because obviously, right? It's great, but it's a problem because you've got to rethink. You got to rethink what you're doing. Whenever this happens to me, it freaks me out. I don't want to be right for the wrong reasons, because then you kind of third and fourth guess yourself.
I think being right for the wrong reasons counts. I think it counts. No, that actually happens to me a lot. And I also do some chart work. You know, I'm sort of a, you know, like a tourist technician. And You know, I put probably too much faith in my chart work, but I'll get to a trade from looking at charts, and I'll sort of construct a thesis around it. And I'm going to say, okay, this stock is going to go down because this is going to happen. And ultimately the stock goes down, but the thesis never played out. And I'm like, well, it's kind of like the SATs, where you have a smart person that doesn't know the answer to the question, but they can pick it out of a lineup. Like, there's some sophisticated intelligence going on there. So I think it counts.
It definitely counts. The puzzle part is, okay, here's what I think is going to happen. And if that happens, here's what's going to follow next. And this is how I make money out of it. But when you're making the money and everything you thought was going to happen is not happening, for me, it really messes with my head, because I'm thinking, okay, should I just take this money because I don't deserve it and get out of the trade because I was wrong? And I need some help here. I need to understand how you handle this stuff, because it really messes with my head.
No, it doesn't really mess with my head. It's basic trading. You know, you want to do more of what works and less of what doesn't. So if something's working, you let it go or you add to the trade. And if it's not working, then you get out. Pretty simple.
All right. Fair enough. I will listen to this part again and again and again, try and get it into my thick head. So let's talk about a couple of things that I know that you spend a lot of time focusing on. And the first one is gold. I know you, like me, are, let's call it, an aficionado of gold. You understand its place in a portfolio, and it's something that for a while now you've been constructive about. Talk to me about what you think is going on in the gold market and gold's place in a portfolio right now.
Kind of a longer discussion. I'll try to make it as short as I can.
No, take your time, buddy. Unless you've got time constraints, I'm happy to sit all day talking to you.
Yeah, so I think that inflation has come down, and I think that we will get complacent about it and lower rates, and it'll go up in the future. I think we'll get a second wave of inflation, okay? I think that wave of inflation will cause interest rates to go up to the point where they become untenable, and the Fed has to contemplate capping interest rates. And we're doing direct monetization of debt. We've been trending in this direction for the last 15 years. And this is a long-term thesis. I'm not talking about 2024 or 2025. This could be 5-10 years from now. But we are trending towards direct monetization of debt. And that is the end game for gold. So I kind of saw that back in 2005. For whatever reason, I saw it in 2005. And I said to myself, I was like, look, over a 20 or 30 year period, I think gold is going to outperform stocks. It's really all it comes down to it. So since 2005, the interesting thing is that gold has basically been equal with stocks. You haven't really lost anything by being in gold. And if you invested in gold in 2000, you'd be ahead of the game. You'd be ahead of stocks. So, I mean, in the short term, sure, I was sitting on the couch on Sunday night watching that print at like 21.35, and I was counting my money and I was all happy and stuff like that. I mean, you always got to watch Sunday nights in Asia. It's funny, like I'm looking at my screen now as we're talking and we're back below 2000. So I am a long-term holder of gold. I don't trade it. If I traded it, I would be broke. I would be absolutely broke. I don't understand it. I would be always wrong. I would do a terrible job.
I mean, I see your lips moving, but it sounds like it's me talking. I'm exactly the same. But again, this is something else I want to ask you about, because you can have this long-term view about gold, a 10, 20-year view about gold, and at the same time be trading in and out of many, many stocks at the same time. And a lot of people struggle. They either pick a side. I'm either a long-term investor or I'm a trader. And it's tough for a lot of people to kind of be able to have a structural position in something that they believe is a long-term value and also trade the swings of the market. How do you separate the two mindsets?
I kind of don't. I would say I have three time frames. One is ultra long-term, like gold, which is decades. And two, I would say, would be 6 months to 2 years. And three would be days or weeks. I don't trade gold. It's always in the long-term bucket, but there is stuff I trade kind of short and medium term. And I'm sort of able to compartmentalize that in my head.
Let me ask you a couple of other things. I'm curious as to what you think about Bitcoin, because again, Bitcoin is one of these assets that you've been on both sides of the table. And again, it's such a polarizing asset and everybody feels like they have to pick a side. Not only do they have to pick a side, they've got to try and entice as many people from the other side over to their side. That's really the whole point of the game. But you've been bullish, you've been bearish, you've been long, you've been short, you've had no position. Where are we currently in Bitcoin, do you think?
I'm not really sure. The one thing I will say about Bitcoin is that you got to give credit to Michael Saylor.
Ooh, I struggle with that, but go on, let me hear this.
So Saylor, he's insane. He's an insane person, but you got to give him credit because he was bullish on Bitcoin at 69,000 and he was bullish on Bitcoin at 16,000. And he never stopped tweeting about Bitcoin throughout that whole time period. Even when Bitcoin was on the lows, he never stopped. His faith was never shaken. You have a lot of people who are tourists who, when Bitcoin was at 16,000, they were completely demoralized and they weren't tweeting about Bitcoin anymore. And now that it's at 45,000, they won't shut up. So I think those people are posers. I think they're absolute posers. And I think they're just totally driven by their own emotions and sentiment. And if you're happy when something goes up and you're sad when it goes down, you are doing it wrong. You should be happy when it goes down and you should be sad when it goes up. It's just all backwards.
Yeah, I hear that. Although I will say, going back to the Saylor thing, I think that there are plenty of people who the day after the rapture was supposed to happen doesn't come, their faith isn't shaken either. So I'm not quite sure if I share your thoughts about Saylor. But it's been fascinating to watch. You know, for me, coming back to the book, the idea of risk, the idea of stress, and watching Bitcoin, as I was reading the book, I kept thinking about Bitcoin because nowhere has there been, I think, a better demonstration of all the things you talk about in the book in terms of stress and risk and inappropriate leverage and all the things you talk about. For me, they all get wrapped into Bitcoin somehow, somewhere. And I guess also the meme stocks of a few years ago. These very high profile, very fast moving things that suck in a lot of people, suck in a lot of capital, they tend to make people forget about all the lessons that you put out so well in the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think if something returns a lot, it's usually risky. And I think there's a place for that in your portfolio. I don't remember if I talked about this in the book, but if you wanted to have 1 or 2 or 3% of your portfolio in something risky that could have high returns, I think there's a place for that. Making it 100% of your portfolio, you're just going to cause yourself a lot of stress. Look, there's a certain percentage of people who are risk averse, and there are a certain percentage of people who are risk seeking, and they seek out as much volatility as possible. And that's kind of how they get their fix. They're gamblers. But for the average person that doesn't want that kind of heartache, 2% of your portfolio is fine.
Is that really the first thing we all need to understand then? Is what is our risk appetite? You know, you talk about the attitude in the first part of the book and having to want more money. Is a big part of that, okay, I need to understand what my appetite and my tolerance for and of risk are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you walked into Edward Jones and you sat down with a financial advisor, the first question they would ask you is, what is your risk appetite? Conservative, moderate, or aggressive? Like, those are the three choices. And the funny thing about that, this is kind of a separate issue, but this kind of varies on a per-person basis, but there's some financial advisors who would say, oh, you're conservative. Well, you'll be in all stocks, but we're just going to put you in dividend stocks or tobacco stocks or something like that. Like, that's their definition of conservative. Like, it kind of varies from person to person. So,
yeah, it's so true. Well, listen, before we close, give us a quick tease of the next book. You said it's going to be a collection of short stories. Have you started thinking about it in anything other than a kind of abstract way yet?
It's done.
Come on, seriously?
Yeah. Yeah.
How the hell do you do this? How the hell can it be done? Do you never sleep? You said it took you 5 years to write. Was it All Evil in This World? It took you 5 years to write.
Yeah, I was a perfectionist about that book. So it's 16 stories. It's called Night Moves. And I'm going to the AWP Writers Conference in Kansas City in February. And I'm going to be speaking with some indie publishers and try to get it published that way. If I can't get an indie publisher, then I'll just self-publish it, which is fine. Like, that's okay. But yeah, that should be coming out around the end of next year.
And what kind of stories are they? Are they finance-based, or have you stepped completely away from this world?
No, it's nothing to do with finance. Nothing to do with finance. No, I can't generalize about them. They have a big emotional impact, really big emotional impact. They're very plot-heavy. It's not strictly literary fiction. It's very plot heavy. They're stories. I actually think there's a couple of them that I could probably sell film rights to, you know, which is one of the reasons why I want to publish it pretty quickly.
Well, listen, my friend, I wish you all the luck with your next book. Well, let's wish you all the luck with the current book right now, because that's out on the bookshelves. And again, you know, no worries. It's such a superb book. My congratulations on it. Honestly, it really is a fantastic read. And I hope everybody that's listening to this conversation either buys a copy for themselves or as far as I'm concerned, buy copies for their kids and let their kids understand this stuff. Because these are the kind of lessons that, you know, I wish I'd known when I was younger and had time to do something about it. So congratulations on that. Congratulations on the Daily Dirt Nap. Just let people know how they can find out more about that and where to find you on Twitter if they don't follow you already, which I'm sure everybody does.
I'm on Twitter at Daily Dirt Nap. And if you want to pre-order the book, we have a website for it. It's called buynoworries.com. You can just go to buynoworries.com and there's a whole bunch of retailers there you can buy it from. So it comes out January 23rd, 2024. And actually, I would like for it to be a New York Times bestseller. I think it's possible, like in the first week, if I get to a certain number of pre-orders, it is possible that it would be a bestseller. So give it a try. Like Grant said, buy it for your kids.
Well, I'm going to do my part to make sure you get on that list, mate. I'm going to order a bunch of copies for Christmas for people. So again, Jared, thanks for doing this, mate. It's been way, way too long. Let's do it again before too long.
Thanks, Grant.
Well, there you have it, folks. Just terrific. You know, Jared is such an interesting character. He's a phenomenal workhorse when it comes to publishing, both with the Daily Dirt Nap, which comes out every single day of the week, and his books. And again, just to reiterate, you'll find all Jared's books at jareddillion.com. Go to dailydirtnap.com and you'll find his market work, which is exceptional. And the book, No Worries, How to Live a Stress-Free Financial Life, will be published, as Jared just said there, 23rd of January next year. And I cannot recommend it highly enough. I think it's not only a really enjoyable book, but also a really important book. So please buy yourself a copy, buy your friends, buy your kids copies. They will thank you for it. That's it for me. I will be back with another guest in the not-too-distant future. In the meantime, as always, thank you so much for listening. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.